All right, guys, I am joined by engineer Brett Rader. What's going on, Brett?
Nothing, just, you know, recording some ads.
Yeah, because today we're talking about the bathroom reader. Have you heard of these, Brett? I think I was vaguely familiar with them.
Yes, my family strictly know nothing in the toilets, but I've been to many friends' house and they have the bathroom reader there and I get an enjoyment out of it.
It is a clear dividing line. I asked to come over to Brett's house for dinner. He said, no, you're a family that has books in the bathroom. Anyways, since 1987, basically what they did is they invented the internet, printed on paper. They describe the topics that they cover as unknown origins, forgotten history, strange news, pop science, dumb crooks, wordplay, and much, much more. Man, these people are kind of trying to step into our territory.
I know. Like, I was going to say, I hope you don't feel offended, but it's if anything, kind of pre-cracked for the toilet bowl.
Yeah. As unambitious as we are, I still feel like we take ourselves too seriously to acknowledge that we're basically just a bathroom reader. So these people are basically a more self-actualized cracked. And guys, June is National Bathroom Reading Month, and the company is going to be celebrating by giving away an entire collection of their imprint titles, which they have over 80 of them. So visit their website in June for details. And if you want a dose of trivia, you can go to bathroomreader.com/cracked to download a free mini ebook. Bathroom Reader, since 1987, printing the internet on paper and letting you poop in front of it. Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and today we're talking about something that's incredibly important that we kind of totally take for granted. Just in time to miss Mother's Day by 2 whole weeks, which seems appropriate. Your mom carried you inside her body for almost an entire year and, you know, worked her ass off and sacrificed her interests, comfort, happiness, so that you could go on wearing MC Hammer pants, if you're anything like me. And in return, they get the heart tattoos that let them know they gave birth to the guy with the least to say in the biker gang. And the people on TV whose minds go blank at the end of an interview and blurt out, "Hi, Mom," that Tupac song he recorded from inside prison. There's an old Cracked article by Michael Swaim about scientific theories that'll make your head explode, in which he offers this thought experiment up that I really like. And I quote, "At some point, half of you was an egg in your mother's womb. That egg existed in her body from the day she was born. And a long, long time ago, she too was an egg in her mother's womb who had that egg ready to go from her birth. And technically speaking, there's no break in that chain of existence. No time when you're not a life form of at least the most rudimentary sort. Your family, at least on your mother's side, could theoretically be considered an immortal, constantly regenerating organism." I did shorten that up in places. Sorry, Michael. Can't help it. I'm an editor. But I love that paragraph because I think it gets at how we're going to be thinking about history on today's podcast. Not as a series of loosely assembled ideas that we can choose to take or leave. History invented every word you've ever said, every thought you've ever had was made of thoughts other people had before you. You don't always know who they were or why that idea lasted, and in fact, they're probably at their most influential when you don't know who made them up and think you made them up yourself, like in the movie Inception. But you're at this moment just one part of an unending chain of people and ideas that stretch back to the beginning of time. We give ourselves all the credit because that's the part that we can see right now, but this moment is not any more impactful or important than all the millions of invisible moments stretching all the way back to the beginning of history. And in fact, those moments can have the advantage because they get to be invisible when they push and pull you around. And that's what we're talking about, or at least that's the idea that's hardest to get your mind around, is just how influential everything that a bunch of people who died before you were even born decided for you already. The neighborhood you grew up in, the school you went to, the things you were taught at that school, The words that were used to teach them all determined a lot of things for you. We've covered before on this podcast the fact that the ancient Greeks didn't have a word for blue because they didn't need one, because there was the color of the stuff behind clouds and the color of the ocean, and so that was that. Being able to describe different shades of blue wasn't practically important before the invention of dyes. And when you read them try to describe something blue, it's like they're wearing blue blocker sunglasses. They literally saw color differently because nobody had invented a word for blue yet. And we perceive color the way we do because somebody eventually did invent the word blue. And even the idea of writing something down had to be invented. I don't think I fully appreciated the fact that the Odyssey and the Iliad, those ancient epic poems that are studied by entire university departments, are important not just because they have wicked three-headed monsters, but because they're the first things ever written down, or at least the first ambitious things that we can find record of being written down. They're the start of the written record before anything written in the Bible, anything written by Mark Twain. I know, he seems like he would be the oldest. But yeah, for the first 99% of our existence as a species, nobody had come up with that idea to write stuff down. I might have given more of a shit about the classics if I'd known that. But as we'll talk about, we're terrible at teaching and learning context. And I think we're bad at context for a reason. You hear people say, we're all the same. Can't you see that we're all the same? When they're trying to get two groups to stop throwing rocks at each other. And one of the questions I think gets indirectly raised in today's conversation is whether that's not actually the thing that we fear. The fact that we're all the same, the sense that the words and ideas and neighborhoods and rules that happen to shape us are the only things that are different. I don't know, that's terrifying because it means we're not special, and it's terrifying because it implies how incredibly powerful and transformative the people who invented our words and ideas and built our neighborhoods really are. But it's also just hard to keep in mind that words don't affect the thoughts you have, they are the thoughts you have. And somebody you've never met invented them, and like a really great mom, when those words and ideas and institutions are doing their job well, we don't notice them. And that not noticing is what we're talking about today, because it leads to a lot of the arguments we find ourselves having even more and more right now. So hope you enjoy it. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. I'm joined on the phone by Jason Pargin, New York Times bestselling author who writes on the site as David Wong. Hello, Jason.
Hello, and okay, we do have to address this. I have actually bought a microphone that may or may not be working for this episode of the podcast, but people are going to notice. So I don't even know if it's necessary to tell people I'm joining by phone in the future.
Yeah.
Even though I am. I think the big thing, like the big point we're going to be making in this hour-long episode is just how smooth my voice is, because most people don't realize that. They've only heard me over a phone line, and I think every point we're about to make, and it's a heavy subject, but I think the main takeaway from this is going to be I have a very smooth voice.
Yeah, we're going to be ranking the top five vowels to hear Jason say in this new format.
Before this moment, I thought he was just a malfunctioning robot.
Oh, yeah. We're also joined by Serge.
I'm here. Serge.
Serge. We call him Sarge.
Sergio.
He is
my complete name.
Joshua Sargent, JF Sargent on the site. How are you, Sarge?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good. And the subject of this week's episode, at least the jumping off point, is a column that we're publishing tomorrow from Jason, at least tomorrow, the day that this is dropping. But it's about trees and Billy Joel's song, We Didn't Start the Fire, I believe is the best way to encapsulate that. Now, Jason, why don't you just kind of give people a little bit of an introduction about kind of what you're writing about?
Sure. And before I do that, just to delay this even slightly, even longer, I am going to plug my book, which is the reason I haven't been on this podcast in like a month, because I'm in the crazy part of book stuff.
Oh, weird. Didn't notice. You haven't been on in a while?
I have the new novel is coming out in the fall called Futuristic Violence in Fancy Suits, and you can pre-order it now any of the places where you buy books, at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Book Carnival, in any of the book retailers. And it's a story about a future where they've got the technology to basically give people superpowers, and it's just a disaster. And this is following the story of people who do not have powers and are trying to sort of clean up the mess of that.
When I said that you were a New York Times bestselling author, I thought I was lying, but Brett just called it up on our research sheet here, and apparently that's true. The bestselling novel was from your John Dies at the End series, which is a sort of epic series of two novels that you started writing accidentally. So this is going to be the first David Wong novel that you started writing intentionally to be a novel, right? Because John Dies at the End was just like something you did for a goof in the forums at first.
That's exactly correct. And then the first one became a movie featuring Paul Giamatti and other actors, including the voice of Patrick on SpongeBob SquarePants, Clancy Brown. And then the second one became a New York Times bestseller, but it all grew out of, as you said, just sort of a prank I was doing on Halloween, and it just kind of ballooned out from there, and now this has consumed my life for the last 15 years.
Same origin story as Jurassic Park, actually, also started on our forums, weirdly. A lot of people don't know that.
So anyway, back to the column, the subject of today's podcast. Yeah, you brought up the Billy Joel song, We Didn't Start the Fire. I don't know how much of a cultural touchstone that is for our readers who are younger than me. When I was a teenager, I guess it was in high school when that came out. It came out in the early 90s, I think. And if you've never heard it, I've embedded a copy of it in the column. But it's basically Billy Joel kind of rapid fire screaming into a microphone all of the bad things in the world that he didn't cause. Like, that's why it's called We Didn't Start the Fire, because it's him. He's acting like he was accused of ruining the world, he personally. And the entire song is a defense of him shouting off various tragedies and odd things from the news and saying, see, I didn't cause that thing either. That also wasn't me. We didn't start the fire. It was started before we got here, even though most of the things he calls out are things from his lifetime. But I guess his point was, I just played the piano in that bar. I wasn't involved in the Cold War or the Cuban Missile Crisis or any of those things.
Yeah, he said that it's sort of a summary of all the different kind of events from his life. Like, he was like, all right, what year was I born? I wrote down 1949, and I was like, all right, Harry Truman was president. And like, the first lyric is Harry Truman. But the other kind of effect, I do think that this is probably one of those pop hits from the early 90s that hasn't stood the test of time. We constantly complain about the downsides of people's short memories and like forgetting the lessons of history, but I think this is one of the good instances where we've forgotten something.
I'm reading the lyrics right now. It quickly devolves into nonsense.
Well, yeah, because a lot of it is not tragic. DiMaggio, it starts Harry Truman, Doris Day, Red China, Johnny Ray, line, South Pacific, Walter Winchell, Joe DiMaggio. Joe DiMaggio was just a good baseball player,
the
man.
The line, Eisenhower, vaccine, England's got a new queen, is particularly great. Those are three ideas, Billy.
Yeah.
Well done.
The invention of vaccination, and then something he noticed on the front page of the New York Post. Ah, England's got a new queen, so that's something.
Yeah, because, and I could go ahead and sing the song now, but I think there are licensing issues with it. I think it would cost about $15,000, which we may decide it's worth it. I don't, you know, we would certainly get more than $15,000 worth of entertainment out of that. But the column is not about the song. It's just a starting point, because that's just such an awful song, and it sometimes gets stuck in my head. The point is that we all kind of have that we didn't start the fire mentality. And I know this because at Cracked, we will occasionally, actually not all that often, like once every few weeks, we'll do an article that mentions sexism or racism or some other social justice issue. And our largely white readership sometimes gets really, really angry about that. Like, sometimes gets really, really, really angry. And the reason for it, and it's the same thing anywhere you go on the internet, the reason for it's pretty logical, which is that I didn't cause slavery. That was my great-great-grandparents. I didn't pass Jim Crow laws. I've never discriminated against anybody. Even the things that are going on today, that isn't me. So please stop bothering me with these things. I'm, you know, not the one who forced women to get back alley abortions or prohibited them from voting. That happened before I got here. So why is this crap keep coming up? Why do we have to keep hearing about it? Why are you trying to make me feel guilty for being born white? Isn't that, in fact, a form of racism and discrimination? In other words, the response most people have to that is to simply reemphasize how terrible slavery was. And it's like, well, no, you don't get it. Jim Crow was really, really bad. You know, the things that happened to civil rights leaders was really, really bad. And it's like, yeah, but I didn't start that fire. That still wasn't me. And I think the premise of this column is that's coming at it from completely the wrong direction.
Yeah, and I think to put that in slightly broader context, during the Baltimore uprising, CNN's coverage seemed to start from a point of, we're all rational people, we all use the correct PC terms, and they're behaving irrationally. So it's like, here's us today, and like CNN anchors are constantly quoting, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. and like his stances on tolerance, and look at how these people are behaving. And it's really sort of a way of viewing things as, look, we're now a progressive society. There's no room for this sort of thing. So I think that beyond just the violent reactions in our comment sections to anything implying that white men are not on the exact same playing ground in popular culture as every single other type of person, I think that is one of the main disconnects in modern popular culture.
You know, we've talked about this on previous podcasts, the fact that one of the really big and notable changes or advancements in society as a good thing is that people being judged as individuals. I don't think that a lot of people listening to this realize that for most of history, your destiny was sort of decided by the family you're a part of, the region you're a part of. You know, if you were born to a blacksmith, you know, your last name was Smith, you were going to be a blacksmith too. And so, you know, a lot of our pop culture revolves around people breaking out of a mold and breaking out of, you know, being judged by what you do, not by your race, not by anything else. Each person judged as an individual. So it's very easy for white people like me to say, exactly, you therefore cannot be in my ear yammering on and on about slavery because I'm no more connected to that than anyone else. Like, I could have been the child of a slave, I could be the child of a slaveholder, I could be the child of neither. It's all irrelevant. We're all just individuals and we have to treat each other as individuals.
It's also like an insane myth that we have achieved that at this point. Like, there's so many, we've run studies on the site about how we react instinctively to people differently based on the color of their skin or their appearance or their accent, and it's everywhere. So like,
yeah,
even though we aspire to that, it's still like we've fallen comically short of that in our day-to-day existence and in the, you know, broad strokes of society.
Yeah, and it's America's favorite fantasy. It's the reason that every Disney movie stars an orphan, because we like to think of ourselves as orphans who had no advantage whatsoever and are just like sort of starting from scratch. It's the reason that, you know, we pretend that there's no such thing as like political dynasties, or we're like anti-England and anti-monarchy and like lionize the founding fathers, but we're about to have an election that could come down to Clinton versus Bush. So it's this really strong myth that runs throughout our culture that is one of the biggest gaps of kind of cognitive dissonance in American culture, it kind of feels like.
Yeah, and the point that I'm making in the column isn't, but the world's still really racist, you guys, which is a completely separate point. It's that saying that it actually doesn't logically make sense to think of yourself as an individual, almost like you arrived on this planet separately. Because every single thing about who you are, from your genes, to your upbringing, everything about your attitudes, your personality, what type of person you are, whether or not you're aggressive or passive, whether or not you're energetic or lazy. All of these things are either due to your genes or due to the way your parents raised you. And then the third factor is just your environment, the society you were raised in, the history. All of those things inform your attitudes, your values, everything, every decision you make, everything you think about what you can be or couldn't be. You were kind of molded into that shape like a jello, whether you noticed it or not. You are still an individual that can make decisions, but the individual that is making those decisions was crafted by lives that came before you. So if you had been born in Saudi Arabia, it wouldn't be you visiting Saudi Arabia. You would be a different person if you grew up in that environment. If the Nazis had won World War II, it wouldn't be like you today had traveled to an alternate dimension where the Nazis won World War II. You would be a different person. You would have been raised hearing different things. You would have been raised with different values. Everything about you would be different. So the choices you'd be making from within that framework instead of the framework from within you're making them now. So in the article, I almost compare an individual to being, you're almost like a leaf on a tree, where the tree is like everybody who's ever lived. Because you are a continuation of one thing. And you inherited both a world that was built by your forefathers, all the good things, the society, the system, the roads, the economy. And you also inherited the bad stuff. But you can't disconnect yourself from either one. You can't just disavow, you know what, I disavow my whiteness. Because the fact that you're white, that still follows you into every room you walk into. And the context of every person who came before you follows you around. It doesn't matter what you say. You can say, well, no, let's just start over. I just want to ignore everything that came before now. Just as if a leaf were sentient, it could disavow the tree, but the roots are still feeding it. It can say what it wants. It doesn't actually disconnect it. And everything you have and everything you are is informed by all the stuff that came before, including the racism, the sexism, all the bad things.
It would be an extremely full of shit leaf if it was sentient and was like, no, I'm just this one thing chilling up here. And it might be good to move off the tree metaphor and start talking kind of like it's a complex point. You're basically making one sort of central idea that is really non-intuitive. And what you're talking about is a particular type of ignorance of just being like, I'm this individual, and ignoring the really bizarre, unique circumstance that particularly white individuals find themselves in, their spot on that tree.
Yeah. And I think in general, most people, like despite getting history classes, you know, every year you're in school, don't have great context for their lives, period. And this isn't just white people, it's anybody. You hear about all these events and you're just made to memorize a bunch of names and dates and that sort of thing. A lot of times either that's presented as trivia, like where you're forced to remember what year they signed this document or what year this country was founded, or else it's presented as like propaganda. Like, you know, well, the founding fathers did this and therefore you need to do that. And it doesn't, I personally don't think we do a great job of putting people's lives in context. Like, you arrived at this part in the story. You're not, your life on its own is not a story. Your life is a sentence that is part of a giant epic novel, and that sentence makes no sense out of context. So it's very easy, especially if you were born in a fairly high place in society, to just think, wow, this is the way it is. Because when you talk about like privilege or whatever, what they're talking about is something that you don't have, which is you don't have that, say, presumption of guilt when you walk into a store or whatever.
And it does seem like we are habitually ignore this thing, because I wonder how many of our readers read comments and how many people are aware of like the level of stuff of what we receive. Because I'll write an article, I got like anti-Semitic emails will show up in my email. I'm not Jewish and I have no I wasn't talking about that at all. It's just we'll get intensely old-fashioned racist, old-fashioned misogynist hate that you aren't expecting to see in day-to-day life anymore over these issues, because we seem to have such blinders on about that particular thing, about our own identities. But at the same time, like we ran a video about advertisements that were lying, and nobody had a problem thinking about, you know, how companies have been doing this for a long time. Like, oh yeah, you know, companies lie to us about this, and they can think about these things in broader terms.
Historical context.
They can provide historical context
where
for
they're
a lot
the
of
victim.
Stuff, where they're the victim.
Right.
But as soon as it becomes just the fact that we lump sexism, racism, and, you know, homophobia, rights for trans individuals, we lump all those together into social justice. It's just issues where it's white dudes are at fault. Anything where you find white dudes at fault is a social justice issue, and then everything else occupies a different conversation realm or is some other part of their brain.
That does seem to be the initial sort of knee-jerk dividing line, is anything where you're the victim overcoming obstacles, like the protagonist in a Hollywood movie, then we accept that into our narrative of ourselves. Whereas everything where we're William Longshanks dominating a bunch of villagers and gaining advantage over them, we don't want anything to do with that. And that seems to be the crisis that people are having.
That was Braveheart you just referenced with Longshanks?
Yeah.
I had no idea. I had to Google that because I was idea what you were talking about.
You failed to mention what movie you were talking about there, and it got really weird.
Yeah, sorry. my brain just like slips into this movie summer, logic. The doctor was saying it's my summer. Well, I'm gonna fuck the summer up. Guys, shaving isn't always fun. Sometimes it's a lot of fun. No, you know what? I would argue shaving is never fun. It can be painful. It can be uncomfortable. And let's not forget about how much we have to pay for the right to razor burn up our neck. Harry's is about half the price of the other big branded blades, and they ship for free to your front doorstep. They're better too. Their first blades were made in Germany, and they liked them so much, Harry's just bought the entire factory. Why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades? I don't know. I've literally asked that to myself out loud at the register, and the people who work at CVS were thoroughly weirded out. But anyways, it's half price at Harry's. And with Harry's, you'll get a better shave that respects your skin, face, legs, and your wallet, if you shave that. The starter set is an amazing deal. For $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and 3 razor blades. And with promo code CRACKED, that's us, you can get $5 off your first purchase. That's harrys.com and enter coupon code CRACKED at checkout for $5 off and start shaving better today. Guys, today's sponsor is Casper Mattress. Yes, I've been wanting to thank these guys. These are American-made mattresses at a shockingly fair price. There's plenty of research about the importance of sleep and even more research on how to get better sleep, and Casper's read it all, and they bring 2 comfy technologies together for better nights and brighter days. They have latex foam and memory foam. I don't know what either of those things are. I can tell you, having slept on a Casper mattress for the past 2 months, that it works. It's just fantastic. It's just like the right amount of firmness for me. I don't know. My wife and I both love it. Even better, they have a totally risk-free trial and return policy. They deliver the mattress straight to you. It's like in a little box, kind of rolled up. You let it out, it pops out, you throw it on top of a box spring, and you can try it out for 100 days. So that's 3 months. That's plenty of time to try a mattress out. If you don't like it, they will literally pick it back up from you. And best news, I haven't even mentioned yet, it's $500 for a twin-size mattress and $950 for a king-size mattress. And right now, you can get $50 towards any purchase of a mattress by going to casper.com/cracked. Man, they are really hooking it up, guys. Go to casper.com/cracked using code CRACKED. Gotta know when to hold them, and know when to fold them. And when you hear me say it's not true, it's me, don't even ask why it's over.
Cause see I'm on a mission. I'm coming through, breaking in that window in the kitchen. Banging on get the chest. That's how I made this beat. Everybody listen. I'm a kid from the yard, money me half for me. And if you didn't know, I need it right away. So when you see us in the street, better keep running. High horse of a we coming. Let me calm down. I'm begging you niggas all along now. See you got a problem now. Cause I'm pissing on your lawn now.
Jason, you pointed out that this is like a, I always say history is a nightmare we're waking up from, but the really nightmarish thing for me in particular is that the people who came before us, or at least the class that we gain a lot of our advantage from in particular these days, are the bad guys. They're the ones doing the nightmarish thing. And, you know, modern white males have had the luckiest ride up to this point in history.
But here's where I think we lose a lot of people, and here's where I think a lot of people have even stopped listening.
Great.
Right, there are people listening to this right now who are living in like a one-room apartment or living in a trailer in Kentucky and are struggling to get by, and maybe they've got, you know, a minor criminal record and they can't get a job. Like, they've gotten stuck in the same trap that lower class people get stuck in all the time, and they're white males. So when they hear us sit here and talk about how great white males have it, it's very easy for them to say, A, what in hell are you talking about? Or B, you guys must be talking about yourselves. Like, you must have done very well with your lives and now you're feeling guilty about it, but I'm still out here. I can't afford to heat my trailer in the winter. And you're sitting here talking about how I'm history's greatest winner. And this is where it gets confusing for people, because logically, there is no justification for breaking people up by race or by gender or by sexual preference or by religion and treating that stuff as anything other than trivia. It should, all that matters should be what kind of person you are, what you can do, and so on. But historically, we still have did that. And everything about the system we're living in was built with those ideas in mind. Everything, you know, was built like with the idea that women stay home and that men work and that all the best schools, all the best jobs, all the best leadership positions are reserved for white males. So even if you don't have one of those leadership positions, we're talking about a larger context in which even that guy in the trailer park is less likely to be in jail than a young black male of the same age, is more likely to get into college, and so on. So we're not talking about every single white person. We're saying that in terms of broad trends, whether you personally have benefited from this or not, you are factually living in a society that was built. The institutions, the infrastructure, everything was built to give you an advantage in many ways that you would not perceive unless they were taken away. And it could be as simple as how a jury will perceive you if you ever wind up on trial. So I understand completely somebody's in a very rough spot in their life, not wanting to hear a bunch of crap about how they're to blame for all the world's troubles when they're sitting there just trying to pay their rent. And I completely understand when that person wants to escape in their life by watching a dumb action movie or playing a video game, hearing a website like us go on and on like, wow, that game's racist, or that game, that movie is sexist. It's like, oh my God, I am struggling to buy food here. I play this game to distract myself, to have a couple of hours to myself that I can enjoy. I do not need your freaking white guilt trip about how the game doesn't have enough women in it, or the women are dressed too scantily or whatever. Leave me alone with that crap, because whatever you're talking about, it's not reaching me here. I understand that completely. That's why it's so incredibly difficult for most people to understand what we mean when we try to expand it to this larger context.
Yeah, the thought experiment that helped me kind of get my head around it was just thinking about if I had been born into the exact same circumstances, but in a black family. Everybody in my family has the exact same intelligence. My parents have the same careers they had. I have the same relationship with my sisters that I had, but we are black. We just look different. And there's a number of things. Like, once you actually look at the different ways your life went at various points, you really can see ways in which it would go differently. Like a thing that was shocking to me about a year ago, and now it's been coming up again. There was an amazing interview on Fresh Air on NPR with a guy who is a historian writing about the Housing Act and the government strategy to segregate Black people into certain parts of cities and white people in other parts. Like, it was a concerted effort that they just would not give housing loans after World War II and in the early part of the 20th century to Black families to live in certain parts of a city. And they called it redlining. They traced a red line around a place and said, this is where the Black people are going to live. They won't get housing loans. They'll be paying rent there. And white people will move out into these areas and we'll give them loans. The thing that doesn't come down to us through history is like people like FDR was a lot of this happened during his presidency. And, you know, he had a number of great things. He was a brilliant president, but also a really rich blue blood white guy who was probably incredibly racist. And the policies that they enacted, like the tree metaphor, is really accurate because those things don't go away. Everything gets built on top of those to the point that today, like if I go into an apartment building in New York City and ask if they have a two-bedroom apartment, they'll immediately show it to me. If a Black person who has my exact same age, marital status, income goes into a New York City apartment building, they will be told there aren't any apartments, that the building is full. And everything is built on top of that. And that's not an advantage that I knew I had. That's not an advantage that I consciously was going through life being like, nice, got one over on them, you know?
And that's not a hypothetical that Jank just pointed out there. That's an experiment they do every year for housing discrimination purposes. They'll submit identical applications. And just one with a Black name, one with a white name, or a Black sounding name, or if there's a picture involved, or if they'll send an actor in, one white, one Black, exact same qualifications. You see the same thing every time. Because what happens is there are buildings where they know if there's too many Black people living there, then the white people who pay more will stop coming because, oh, this is the Black building. So they will tell them, no, we've reached our limit of two Black people in this complex.
Right. And it's crazy that, like, at the start of the 20th century, cities were way more integrated. I think it was most Black people lived in neighborhoods that were 30% Black. And today they live in neighborhoods that are 70% Black. And it's the exact problem you saw in Baltimore and that people are talking about in Baltimore. Like, we're talking about a lot about real estate, but the schools that you go to, like the public schools you go to, I was raised in public schools, and the public schools I went to were funded by the taxes on people's property taxes. So that's a huge part of, like, the opportunities that are open to you over the course of your life, like from the very start. And to this day, a family that makes, I think it's $75,000 a year and is Black, lives in a poorer neighborhood on average than a white family that makes $35,000, that makes half the income, because historically they were discriminated against. And so their schools are going to be twice as bad.
When you're a kid and if your mother does your laundry for you and you're little, and then suddenly you have to do your own laundry, it seems insane because you've never had to do it before. And, you know, obviously that's a child learning something, but it's kind of the same thing if something has always happened, the trash someone comes and picks up my trash once a week, you know, if that didn't happen all of a sudden, it would be outrageous. And, you know, if I went to an apartment building and looked for an apartment and they told me that they didn't rent to me, that would be outrageous. But when it doesn't happen, then I just assume it's not happening to anybody and sort of can't conceive of it happening to somebody else. And I think that's kind of related to another issue that keeps people from thinking about it properly, in that it's always, specifically the stuff we talk about, racism in movies, sexism in video games, whatever, it's always presented as being offensive and therefore like we're hurting somebody's feelings. And so it's very easy when we're just thinking in terms of feelings for, you know, the white guy who has priors and can't get a job to think, Well, feelings. Yeah, okay. Yeah, sure. I'm going to look out for your feelings, but I also have my own job. I don't have a job. I have to make payments. I don't want to think about feelings I have. The issues I'm facing are more important than you being offended by God of War 3 or whatever. And I think that's why it's important to get away from, you know, it's when we say offensive, it's not just feelings. It's reinforcing these concepts that have real world ramifications.
The way those feelings can be made real is when some of those white people who have that instinct are the only people in our culture who are allowed to have guns and kill people. That's something that when I see the police, I get tense because I worry that I'm going to be pulled over for speeding. But the reality of me, if I had been born in the exact same circumstances and just happened to be black, what that person would feel is something that's totally foreign to me. Jason, in your column, you do a really good job of explaining how counterproductive that is and how so much of the progress that we're enjoying right now and this sort of explosion of human success, I think you call it humanity dunking on the world, has to do with sort of fighting that trend, fighting those historical things that are standing in the way of just everybody getting a fair shot and the world operating as an actual meritocracy.
Yeah, it's funny because on one hand, I think of myself as a very cynical person, but people think of me as being very optimistic about the world. And it's sort of, I'll explain why. It's because I secretly believe, and I've mentioned this on previous podcasts, that a lot of the progress we've made in terms of equal rights and things like that isn't necessarily because we became better people or that we've made moral progress. It's because we kind of woke up to the idea of how stupid and counterproductive it was. And so what I show on the column, like, you can look at a population graph over the last 2,000 years, and it's a flat line at the bottom. And then starting in the mid-1800s with the Industrial Revolution, it spikes vertically through the roof. We went from like 500 million people to 7 billion people like that.
Insufferable people call it hockey sticks growth.
Yeah, hockey stick. Yeah. And people look at that graph as like alarmism, like, God, there's too many people in the world. And that's a weird way to look at it, because what that is, that's what every single species in the universe wishes it could do. That graph is humanity finally winning and winning so hard. Like, in order to have that kind of success, you have to overcome a million different barriers. Disease, sanitation, wars, organizing large societies, organizing large cities. Things we went hundreds of thousands of years completely failing at. And suddenly it all starts clicking. Like, it all starts working. Our ability to grow food, our ability to conquer medicine, to conquer disease, our ability, you know, to conquer microbes and to get sanitation right.
Yeah, feeding that population is something that I think gets a little bit of press, but like, there's been incredible advances in that. But just knowing what to do with all those people's shit is a huge, like, that was something that really we had a hard time with. We just had an article about like things that are sort of edited out of history. And like, up until 300 years ago, the earth was just covered in human waste. And like, there were, even in cities that like had sewage systems, there were rivers of waste just like rushing under those cities, and buildings would collapse into them and people would be swept away by rivers of shit and never heard from again. And that was a thing that happened.
That's such a great example of a privilege we have without thinking about it.
Like, no
we
clue.
Get to poop in a bowl and then it goes away forever.
Just disappears from existence.
We have a paper there to clean up after, and then it's gone.
Everything you touch from the moment you wake up until the moment you go to bed is like that. It's a miracle. It's a miracle that was made by someone other than you. So everyone listening to this, including the guy in the trailer park, and I'm really acting like a trailer park is just a living hell. I've had many friends who lived in trailer parks, family. It's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But I'm using that example because like, that guy probably thinks he's been left out of all the success. But the truth is that everybody listening to this was born in the middle of an incredible winning streak that not even the dinosaurs saw when they ruled the earth millions of years ago. Like, this is unprecedented. It might be that there's nothing within a million light years of us in this universe that matches what humans have done on this one rock. It's incredible. And you were born right at the cusp of it. This has only been going on just like a few generations. Your great, great, great grandparents were seeing the beginnings of it. Like, you know, the beginnings of industry and all that. What you also see during that incredible winning streak, and it is not a coincidence, is the breaking down of these dumb barriers that had been with humanity all throughout our history, where it used to be, oh, you're the son of blank, therefore you will dig the sewers and that's all you're allowed to do. By starting to emphasize things like universal literacy, which is very recent, the printing press is only invented, you know, a few hundred years ago, and then universal literacy didn't come along till long after that. Universal education, which was one of the big initiatives in, you know, in the colonization of America, but that, again, fairly recent, because once upon a time, if you were born to dig ditches, there was no reason to teach you how to read because you had no chance of aspiring to be anything else. And so then after that, things like, you know, getting women into the workplace and then minorities into the workplace after World War II, all of these things followed in came at the same time as an incredible explosion in human productivity and human creativity, because we had stopped telling 90% of the world's really talented people, we don't need you. Because, yeah, you're a great microbiologist, but you're also a woman, so go make me a sandwich. Yeah, you've got the potential to be, you know, a great designer or poet or writer, but you're black, so go pick cotton with this chain around your neck. This is the way it was until very recently. Lifting those restrictions has brought about unbridled progress simply because we are unleashing all of the female and black and gay and Hispanic geniuses onto the world, where we before had these arbitrary barriers set up by people who simply wanted to preserve the good jobs for themselves and their own children.
To the point that the people who ruled the world, the very few people who ruled the world, would have sex with their own, like, cousins and sisters just so their family could keep all the power to themselves. And therefore, you had, like, these inbred crazy people who, like, ruled the world, made the decisions that would, like, determine which armies fought and, like, died on battlefields. So, like, when you compare that to what we have now, it's, again, it's just one of those things that I don't know that people totally take into context when they're thinking about history and just how horrifying it was.
The point is, I think a lot of people don't realize, because in their lifetime, all they've heard about is, you know, equal rights, Martin Luther King, the civil rights movement, you know, feminism. They think this is me as a white male losing because all these other groups are winning and they're gaining and the world's been turned upside down, and they are not getting this context that all of this stuff you've been hearing that goes all the way back to the democracy movement, you know, in the 1700s that gave birth to America, that like the people should have some control. Like, it was an extension of that philosophy that everybody has something to contribute, and that when everybody contributes, everybody benefits. That black guy who got shot by the police, or that woman who was told she had no choice but to be a housewife, that she or he could have cured your cancer. And even if not, could have been a great person, a great leader, a great something. Now, if a woman chooses to be a housewife, chooses to be a mother, that's great. The world needs mothers. The world needs that. But we are waking up from a nightmare in which the women who could do something else were told no, including the ones who could have cured your cancer. So it is hard for people to understand that you were born in the middle of this scene that's playing out in history. You can think of your life as like one frame in a reel of film that's being pulled through the projector. And we're in the middle of this very exciting scene in which all of the people who had been kind of pushed down to the bottom over the last couple of hundred years have been slowly been allowed to bubble up to the top, to the great benefit of everybody. As the population has exploded, so has standard of living, because more geniuses are being born. more talented people are being born, more great doctors, great thinkers, great leaders. And so when you see a population graph and you think, oh my gosh, who's going to feed all those hungry mouths? You're not looking at a graph of rats. You're looking at a graph of smart, creative human beings who are at the absolute peak of evolution, by which everything from societal evolution to genetic has led us to a point where we are the most capable species in the observable universe, even the lowest of the low. So when you hear people, what it seems like nitpicking around the fringes, oh, this movie's sexist, oh, this movie doesn't have enough white people, or have enough black people rather, it's easy to say, oh my God, why are you wasting time in this trivia? Because they don't understand we are addressing something that over the last 1,000 years has been used to keep people down who otherwise could be great. These forms of exclusion via jokes, via derogatory terms, all these little things, you know, the nicknames, the belittling, referring to black people as boy, all these little things that seem like nothing on their own, they all have a historical context that had done tremendous damage to humanity. Even if you're listening to this, even if you're a neo-Nazi and you feel nothing, like no moral obligation to minorities or to women or whatever, just listen to the fact that it makes the world better when we're not arbitrarily telling groups, you have to behave a certain way or I'm going to make assumptions about you in advance. Because the great progress, the objective great progress in the world and standard of living has coincided with us breaking down those barriers. And a lot of those barriers are seemingly small things, like excluding people from pop culture or portraying them in a certain way in pop culture. That stuff is like a little tumor that grows, and it grows into really ugly thoughts that over the long term, yes, has been used to keep people down.
Yeah, everything we take in throughout our lives is kind of being put into a broad framework. The language that CNN uses to describe the Baltimore riots, to the coverage of the NFL draft and like seeing a bunch of white guys with clipboards and, you know, numbers and analytics looking at a bunch of athletic black guys and everybody just talking about that event like it's the natural order of things. Like just everything around you is kind of building into a broader context of how you understand the world. And that's instinct. That's everything about like how you act and how you make decisions. And all of that context is being built on top of Jason's hippie metaphor tree. It's like that tree. It's growing on a base of what came before.
And even referring to it as what came before, it still kind of undermines it, because it's like the ideas that they gave birth to are still living in your head. Like the stereotypes that, you know, the person who invented it is long gone, but it's still out there. It's still in pop culture. It's still in your framework of how you think of what you expect from the world. It's still alive. That's why the stupid tree thing, it works so well, because you think of history like the roots, like it's still feeding the leaves. Leaves are still drawing nourishment from it. And all of those things were set in motion by people who you never met and maybe had no connection to your family. They're still either helping you or hurting you one way or the other. And when you break it down to an individual level, for instance, when we talk about sexism, a lot of our younger readers, if there's somebody in high school, that sounds insane to them, because they're like, well, I'm in high school, I can't even get women to talk to me, and I see these cheerleaders getting worshipped as gods. Like, they are worshipped. They have crowds of friends. They have crowds of guys trying to give them attention. And then here I am, this nerdy white guy. I have no friends. You know, these girls wouldn't even, you know, they look at me like I'm a peasant that dares to speak to them. How in the world can you tell me that this is a world where men have it all and women are downtrodden? And it's like, right, but the context is you have women that are told you are treasured because you're pretty and your body is shaped a certain way, and their body is only going to be shaped that certain way for a few more years. Whereas your mind and your ability to get a job and have certain attributes given to you just by the fact that you're a male, that you're going to be considered a good leader or a good decision maker or whatever. That stuff is going to be helping you until you're 80 years old. Whereas the woman is going to get into a position where she may get stuck with a baby and a father who doesn't hang around to take care of it. Like, you're looking at the world through the one moment in time where that girl you're talking to happens to be treated like a princess. But you also have to understand that when she goes to get a job, she's 35 years old. She's going to be fighting against, oh, she just got the job because she's pretty, her whole life. And that her opinions are not going to be taken seriously her whole life for the same thing that made people treat her as a goddess before. So the stuff that looks positive in some contexts, like you can sit there and say, well, you know, friggin' LeBron James is worth $1 billion. I'm not worth $1 billion, you know, and he's black. It's like, but he grew out of a system where millions and millions of young black men are told, you either get good at basketball or else you have no chance. So people who go to college and don't come away with an education, but only one in how many make it to the NBA, Jack, probably? Like, out of how many of the high school basketball players in America, what percentage will make it to the NBA and make a living playing pro ball?
No more than, like, 50. I have no idea. It's like some astronomically small number.
Well, we can do the math. An NBA roster only has 12 guys on it.
Yeah.
There's how many teams in NBA? 30?
Yeah.
All right. So you've got less than 400 of those jobs total.
It was probably about 280, I'd estimate, are Americans.
I mean, it was a really big deal when I walked away from my contract to come work for you guys.
Yeah, it's the NCAA system is crazy when you look at it in sort of the broad terms we're talking about.
Right. And so in order to get that one millionaire that you can now hold up as your example of how easy black people have it, you had to sacrifice, I don't know, 100,000, 50,000 other guys who, you know, who basically would forego an education. And again, a lot of them get an education too. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that this colleges in many cases don't give a crap whether or not they get an education because they're there to play ball and the NCAA makes a tremendous amount of money off of basketball, football, and all that. So you're seeing one person who benefited from a system that largely, you know, is maybe sending the wrong message. And you see that all over the place. Each of these systems that kind of keep people down in one way or the other, they've got ways you can look at them that make them seem not so bad, but you have to look at the context.
I want to go to quickly back to the example of the cheerleader, because I think this is kind of one of the most stark examples, because she is in many ways already screwed in one really important respect, and that is from the very beginning, young women are inculcated with the idea that they're not good at math and science and engineering, to the point that very recently the president of Harvard, the smartest institution in America, had to step down or apologize for having basically supported the idea that women brains aren't as good at math and science. And there's a lot of data out there that says, first of all, that that's just never been true about any one type of person. Like, progress always seems to bear out that, no, that's just what you thought because of cultural circumstances that you're putting them in. And from a very young age, young women are absorbing the idea that they're not meant for science. Science is for men. And it starts showing up on testing in a very early age, unless you do extraordinary things to sort of keep them away from those cultural ideas or put them in another country. Now, if you think about that, that is 50% of the population that is just being nipped at the bud of, like, no, you don't do that. And that's 50% of the population that is just not working on curing cancer. Like, that's insane how much that is holding us back as a species, but it's still so ingrained that the president of Harvard is like, well, yeah, I mean, we all know women brains don't do math. So yeah, I think that's another example of just sort of something we're still it's still pretty easy to miss about the tragedy of that cheerleader that you resent for having a small amount of power in high school.
this does come back to about how it's not about feelings. There is that reaction a lot of people have to just be like, to make it about, well, I, and where this one person or this one example, something that this reminds me of is when people talk about minimum wage. Oh, we can't raise the minimum wage because your job, this job just isn't worth $10 an hour. Or, you know, working at McDonald's just isn't worth $15 an hour. And like the reason you have a minimum wage is so that even people working the jobs that you don't think are worth a lot of money can still raise a kid, and that kid can grow up to cure cancer. Because otherwise, the implications are always, whenever you see the reaction that we're talking to in this podcast, where, you know, they get mad at social justice issues and our articles.
It's taking it out of the idea of justice. It's not justice.
Yeah, it's justice, and feelings are not the point.
We want to be better at this. We want to dunk harder.
I want a better cell phone, so I want less sexist video games. And that does plan out. Actually, my big concern is, you know, ants are extremely racist, where they will just go to war just because the ants look different. If all the ants decided to put that aside and fight us, we would lose. And we need to keep ahead of the ants.
Bullshit.
No, there are
fucking ant up.
There are more ants than us, I'm pretty sure.
For every human, there is 10 million ants.
Yeah. Can you fuck up 10 million ants, Jack?
I still win that fight.
I would lose. Start rolling around and just mash them into a paste, really.
I'm so glad Jason knew that off the top of his head. Oh, no. I've been keeping tabs on the ants.
And training them.
I know that from reading Cracked, because I saw that stat and thought, no, that's, they've put, I thought, once again, a writer has put too many zeros on a number. It's like, nope. It's because the actual number of ants on Earth is like 40 quintillion or something. But anyway, I'm sorry we got off on ants there, but that brings me, what you're saying there, Sarge, brings me to, it's like a big point that is the other thing that is almost impossible for people to wrap their heads around, which is that when you say you're making me feel guilty for being white, or you're blaming me for slavery, or blaming me for Jim Crow, there is a distinct and stark difference between blame and responsibility. And the inability to tell the difference between those two things enrages people. There are some cases where it's really easy to see. For instance, if it snows, you're responsible for shoveling your walk, but you're not to blame for it snowing. Blame implies guilt. Blame implies you did something wrong. You didn't do anything wrong at all. It just snowed. But you are still responsible for shoveling the walk. You know, you are responsible for locking up your house when you leave it. If it gets broken into, you're not to blame for the break-in. That's the burglar to blame. He's guilty. You don't go to jail, but you were responsible for locking the house. And you do bear some responsibility, not blame, but responsibility for making it easier for him to break in. When people say, analysts say, that American policies resulted in a lot of terrorism because we accidentally created these terrorist groups by destabilizing governments and the stuff we did in Afghanistan or whatever, that's not to say that we're to blame for 9/11. Is to say that we bear responsibility for what our policies do, and you have to use that to inform what you do in the future. The terrorists are to blame for blowing things up, but you can still be responsible for doing things that made it easier on them, the same as if a security guard fell asleep and let a guy walk past him and blow something up. It's, again, the guard didn't blow it up. He just fell asleep. They are two different things. So it's easy to hear when you talk about everyone is responsible for fixing sexism or racism. It's easy to hear, oh, so you're blaming me. You're blaming me for all this. Because somehow when we were kids and we were told, you clean up your own messes, you spilled it, you cleaned it up, we took that to mean you only clean up your own messes. But in this larger context that we're talking about, where you are a continuing part of a story and a story that is getting better, the entire concept of improving means cleaning up other people's messes. The fixing pollution, you didn't pollute, but you're still going to be responsible for cleaning up if you want clean air to breathe. You didn't make it dirty. You didn't start the fire. It's still your job to put it out. Just because the same reason it's your job to shovel the walk or pay somebody to shovel the walk. It's your sidewalk. There's no, you know, nobody's blaming anybody. That's not the point. So when you start putting in terms of, you know, justice or making people feel guilty or trying to appeal emotionally and making people feel bad, I think they reject that because they rightfully say, I didn't make the world the way it is. I'm just trying to get by day to day. And they don't understand that that's not what we're saying. We're saying if we want the world to get better, and we do, and to keep this winning streak going, everybody is responsible for trying to fight these ideas that have been keeping people down. So if it seems like we keep finding new things to complain about and like, oh, now it's not acceptable to make fun of trans people now, I suppose. Well, yeah, see, that's how progress works. You should be able to look back 10 years and cringe at the jokes you were making. You should be able to look back at the attitudes you had as a teenager and feel terrible about it. And humanity as a whole should be able to look back 1,000 years or 100 years and cringe. It's great that we can watch old Warner Brothers cartoons from the 1940s and see how racist they were, how openly racist they were. And that's good because you couldn't get away with that today, and that's progress. It's not because, oh, people have gone soft, we're all too sensitive these days, or, you know, oh, it's open season on the white people now. No, it's everyone is trying to get everyone to join the party, and all these little shots we take at people, at marginal groups, to kind of keep them down, to humiliate them, to belittle them, that stalls progress. So even if it doesn't touch your heart as a moral issue, and I think for a lot of people it doesn't, just looking at it from an objective point of view, this is how we're going to make the future better for everybody, you included, you there in the hypothetical trailer park that I keep crapping on. 10 years from now, hopefully it'll be unacceptable for me to make fun of trailer parks. That'll be progress. But it's for everybody. The idea is to get to a world where a kid, whether he's born in a trailer park as a white guy, as a poor white guy, or born in rural China as a trans woman, both of them have a maximum chance to be the best thing they can be, whether they're curing cancer or whether they're fixing carburetors on flying cars of the future. Either way, that they have the best chance to be that thing and not be pushed to the margins, not be jailed, not commit suicide due to bullying, and so on. Because that's how the arrow keeps pointing upward.
Until the ants take over.
Until the ants take over.
All right, that was our episode. On to footnotes. First of all, if that stuff about modern day discrimination in the world of real estate sounded far-fetched or more likely boring, I think I did a bad job explaining it. I need you to Google the words This American Life House Rules. Not a fan site for the medical drama, but a really great episode of This American Life. Google those words, find a comfortable place to sit down, and then listen to the whole thing. Also, first, you're going to want to hold on to your butt because it's pretty incredible and does just a fantastic case study of a pretty heartbreaking example that's really relevant today about what we were talking about. If you find that interesting, this week's episode of Fresh Air interviewed a historian on this subject, and it includes stuff like this.
Let me quote something that the mayor of Baltimore said, and I'm not sure if this was in 1910 or shortly after, but this pertains to the restrictive housing ordinance. He said, blacks should be quarantined in isolated slums in order to reduce the incidence of civil disturbance, to prevent the spread of communicable disease into nearby white neighborhoods, and to protect property values among the white majority. That pretty much sums it up. You know, like, yes. what the policies were intended to do. I mean, that's quarantine.
Again, those are not the thoughts of Terry Gross. That's the mayor of Baltimore around the beginning of the 20th century. And he wasn't immediately thrown out of office. The other people in other local governments and the federal government were like, hear, hear, and spent a
large part of the 20th century, creating laws that allowed them to quarantine black people in neighborhoods. And those neighborhoods are the ones you see on the news in Baltimore. And again, you didn't write those laws, you don't even agree with what that guy said, but you live in a world where the policies those people created are still in effect. And it's not your fault, but that doesn't change the fact that it exists right now. History is going to look at the world as it exists right now, and there's always a chance that we didn't mention in our conversation, but there's always a chance that history will go the other direction. Those people will be like, man, those people were too uptight. Human civilization peaked in the early 90s. Pauly Shore comedies are hilarious. That's just not the direction things have been moving since we started dunking on nature with our machines. For the past few hundred years, they've been moving faster and faster in a direction that'll make the world as it exists today look like the 1800s to our grandkids, and maybe, hopefully, even our kids. In fact, it's been accelerating faster. If the past couple decades is any indication, by the time I have kids, I'm going to sound like one of those characters from the Hudsucker proxy when I talk to them, because things will have changed so much. All right, musically speaking, we opened with Bitch Better Have My Money, the new Rihanna song that I love. I love that she's taunting a dude by claiming his wife is in the backseat of her car. For far too long, brags about driving away with other men's wives was, like engineering and the sciences, jealously guarded by only males. Rihanna is the first female celebrity I can remember who just really seems to be playing all the dudes, Drake, Chris Brown, Leonardo DiCaprio. I can picture them all just looking at the dot, dot, dot on a text message that they sent her, and then like that going away and just staring at it for 20 minutes, waiting in vain. She's cool, is what I'm saying. We listened to the song Fuck the Summer Up. You might have recognized it as the one we went into the ad listening to that kept promising that it was about to fuck the summer up. That's by someone called Leeka Lee 47, a Brooklyn rapper who wears a ski mask, according to Google Image Search. And I just love the way this song sounds, and I just like it as a mission statement for me personally for the next few months. I am going to fuck the summer up. You've been warned. And we're going to ride out on A Message to You, Rudy, a 1979 Specials cover of a 60s Rocksteady song. But the Specials are a ska band, and I think that's a good example, a good word of caution to put here, is human culture isn't always progressive. The ancient Greeks became modern Greece. Sorry, modern Greece. Rome fell and begat the Dark Ages, and ska, that ended up sounding like ska music in the 90s, sounded like this awesome song in 1979. And yeah, it eventually became all the bands that haunted my high school in the 90s. But this is a great song. I think I played on my video show, The Spit Take, but in case you missed it there, figured I'd share it here. I don't know why it turned into hee-haw at the end there, but that is the end of this episode, and we'll be back in 2 weeks, dark next week, back in 2 weeks with more podcast. Talk to you then, guys. We'll be right back.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio, boom.com. Oh, oh, oh. The wolf dead.